After a second, the boy nodded with a strange shivering about his mouth and said, "Let's go home before we get ourselves lost again." Their train glided into the suburb stop just as they reached the station, and they boarded it together. And 10 minutes before it was due to arrive at the junction, they went to the door and stood ready to jump off it if it did not stop. But it did, just as the moon, restored to its full splendor, sprang from a cloud and flooded the clearing with light. As they stepped off, the sage grass was shivering gently in shades of silver, and the clinkers under their feet glittered with a fresh black light. The treetops, fencing the junction like the protecting walls of a garden, were darker than the sky, which was hung with gigantic white clouds illuminated like lanterns. Mr. Head stood very still and felt the action of mercy touch him again. But this time he knew that there were no words in the world that could name it. He understood that it grew out of agony, which is not denied to any man, and which is given, in strange ways, to children. He understood it was all a man could carry into death to give his Maker, and he suddenly burned with shame that he had so little of it to take with him. He stood appalled, judging himself with the thoroughness of God, while the action of mercy covered his pride like a flame and consumed it. He had never thought himself a great sinner before, but he saw now that his true depravity had been hidden from him, lest it cause him despair. He realized that he was forgiven for sins from the beginning of time, when he had conceived in his own heart the sin of Adam, until the present, when he had denied poor Nelson. He saw that no sin was too monstrous for him to claim as his own, and since God loved in proportion as he forgave, he felt ready at that instant to enter paradise. Nelson, composing his expression under the shadow of his hat brim, watched him with a mixture of fatigue and suspicion. But as the train glided past them and disappeared like a frightened serpent into the woods, even his face lightened, and he muttered, "I'm glad I've went once, but I'll never go back again." A Circle in the Fire. Sometimes the last line of trees was a solid gray-blue wall, a little darker than the sky, but this afternoon it was almost black, and behind it the sky was a livid, glaring white. "You know that woman that had that baby in that iron lug?" Mrs. Pritchard said. She and the child's mother were underneath the window the child was looking down from. Mrs. Pritchard was leaning against the chimney, her arms folded on a shelf of stomach, one foot crossed and the toe pointed into the ground. She was a large woman with a small pointed face and steady, ferreting eyes. Mrs. Cope was the opposite, very small and trim, with a large round face and black eyes that seemed to be enlarging all the time behind her glasses, as if she were continually being astonished. She was squatting down pulling grass out of the border beds around the house. Both women had on sun hats that had once been identical, but now Mrs. Pritchard's was faded and out of shape, while Mrs. Cope's was still stiff and bright green.
"I read about her," she said.
"She is a Pritchard that married a Brookins and so's kin to me, about my 7th or 8th cousin by marriage."
"Well, well,"
Mrs. Cope muttered, and threw a large clump of nut grass behind her. She worked at the weeds and nut grass as if they were an evil sent directly by the devil to destroy the place.
"Bein' she was kin to us, we gone to see the body," Mrs. Pritchard said. "Seen the little baby, too."
Mrs. Cope didn't say anything. She was used to these calamitous stories. She said they wore her to a frazzle. Mrs. Pritchard would go 30 miles for the satisfaction of seeing anybody laid away. Mrs. Cope always changed the subject to something cheerful, but the child had observed that this only put Mrs. Pritchard in a bad humor. The child thought the blank sky looked as if it were pushing against the fortress wall, trying to break through. The trees across the near field were a patchwork of gray and yellow greens. Mrs. Cope was always worrying about fires in her woods. When the nights were very windy, she would say to the child,
Oh, Lord, do pray there won't be any fires. It's so windy.
And the child would grunt from behind her book or not answer at all, because she heard it so often. In the evenings in the summer, when they sat on the porch, Mrs. Cope would say to the child who was reading fast to catch the last light,
"Get up and look at the sunset. It's gorgeous. You ought to get up and look at it."
And the child would scowl and not answer, or glare up once across the lawn and two front pastures to the gray-blue sentinel line of trees, and then begin to read again with no change of expression, sometimes muttering for meanness,
"It looks like a fire. You better get up and smell around and see if the woods ain't on fire."
"She had her arm around it in the coffin," Mrs. Pritchard went on. But her voice was drowned out by the sound of the tractor that the Negro Culver was driving up the road from the barn. The wagon was attached, and another Negro was sitting in the back, bouncing, his feet jogging about a foot from the ground. The one on the tractor drove it past the gate that led into the field on the left. Mrs. Cope turned her head and saw that he had not gone through the gate because he was too lazy to get off and open it. He was going the long way around at her expense.
"Tell him to stop and come here," she shouted.
Mrs. Pritchard heaved herself from the chimney and waved her arm in a fierce circle, but he pretended not to hear. She stalked to the edge of the lawn and screamed,
"Get off, I told you! She wants you!"
He got off and started toward the chimney, pushing his head and shoulders forward at each step to give the appearance of hurrying. His head was thrust up to the top in a white cloth hat streaked with different shades of sweat. The brim was down and hid all but the lower parts of his reddish eyes. Mrs. Cope was on her knees, pointing the trowel into the ground.
"Why aren't you going through that gate there?"
she asked and waited. Her eyes shut and her mouth stretched flat as if she were prepared for any ridiculous answer.
"Got to raise the blade on the mower if we do,"
he said, and his gaze bore just to the left of her. Her Negroes were as destructive and impersonal as the nutgrass. Her eyes, as she opened them, looked as if they would keep on enlarging until they turned her wrong side out.
"Raise it," she said, and pointed across the road with the trowel.
He moved off.
"It's nothing to them," she said. "They don't have the responsibility. I thank the Lord all these things don't come at once. They'd destroy me."
"Yeah, they would,"
Mrs. Pritchard shouted against the sound of the tractor. He opened the gate and raised the blade and drove through and down into the field. The noise diminished as the wagon disappeared.
"I don't see myself how she had it in it," she went on in her normal voice.
Mrs. Cope was bent over, digging fiercely at the nutgrass again.
"We have a lot to be thankful for," she said. "Every day you should say a prayer of thanksgiving. Do you do that?"
"Yes'm," Mrs. Pritchard said.
"See, she was in it for 4 months before she even got that away. Looked like to me if I was in one of them, I would leave off. How you reckon they—"
"Every day I say a prayer of thanksgiving," Mrs. Cope said.
"Think of all we have, Lord," she said and sighed. "We have everything,"
and she looked around at her rich pastures and hills heavy with timber and shook her head as if it might all be a burden she was trying to shake off her back. Mrs. Pritchard studied the woods.
"All I got is 4 abscessed teeth," she remarked. "Well, be thankful you don't have 5.
Mrs. Cope snapped and threw back a clump of grass.
"We might all be destroyed by a hurricane. I can always find something to be thankful for."
Mrs. Pritchard took up a hoe resting against the side of the house and struck lightly at a weed that had come up between 2 bricks in the chimney.
"I reckon you can," she said, her voice a little more nasal than usual with contempt. "Why, think of all those poor Europeans," Mrs. Cope went on, "that they put in boxcars like cattle and rode them to Siberia. Lord," she said, "we ought to spend 1/2 our time on our knees."
"I know if I was in an iron lung, there would be some things I wouldn't do,"
Mrs. Pritchard said, scratching her bare ankle with the end of the hoe.
Even that poor woman had plenty to be thankful for, Mrs. Cope said. She could be thankful she wasn't dead.
Certainly, Mrs. Cope said. And then she pointed the trowel up at Mrs. Pritchard and said, I have the best-kept place in the county, and do you know why? Because I work. I've had to work to save this place and work to keep it.
She emphasized each word with the trowel. I don't let anything get ahead of me, and I'm not always looking for trouble. I take it as it comes.
If it all come at once sometime, Mrs. Pritchard said,
it doesn't come all at once, Mrs. Cope said sharply.
The child could see over to where the dirt road joined the highway. She saw a pickup truck stop at the gate and let off three boys who started walking up the pink dirt road. They walked single file, the middle one bent to the side carrying a black pig-shaped valise.
Well, if it ever did, Mrs. Pritchard said, it wouldn't be nothing you could do but fling up your hands.
Mrs. Cope didn't even answer this. Mrs. Pritchard folded her arms and gazed down the road, as if she could easily enough see all these fine hills flattened to nothing. She saw the three boys who had almost reached the front walk by now.
Look at yonder, she said. Who you reckon they are?
Mrs. Cope leaned back and supported herself with one hand behind her and looked. The three came toward them, but as if they were going to walk on through the side of the house. The one with the suitcase was in front now. Finally, about 4 feet from her, he stopped and set it down. The three boys looked something alike, except that the middle-sized one wore silver-rimmed spectacles and carried the suitcase. One of his eyes had a slight cast to it, so that his gaze seemed to be coming from two directions at once, as if it had them surrounded. He had on a sweatshirt with a faded destroyer printed on it, but his chest was so hollow that the destroyer was broken in the middle and seemed on the point of going under. His hair was stuck to his forehead with sweat. He looked to be about 13. All three boys had white, penetrating stares.
I don't reckon you remember me, Mrs. Cope, he said.
Your face is certainly familiar, she murmured, scrutinizing him. Now let's see.
My daddy used to work here, he hinted.
Boyd, she said. Your father was Mr. Boyd and your J.C.?
No, my pal, the second one. I've only growed some since then, and my daddy, he's dead now, done died.
Dead? Well, I declare, Mrs. Cope said, as if death were always an unusual thing. What was Mr. Boyd's trouble?
One of Powell's eyes seemed to be making a circle of the place, examining the house and the white water tower behind it, and the chicken houses, and the pastures that rolled away on either side, until they met the first line of woods. The other eye looked at her.
Died in Florida, he said, and began kicking the valise.
Well, I declare, she murmured.
After a second, she said, And how is your mother?
Mad again.
He kept watching his foot kick the suitcase. The other two boys stared at her impatiently.
And where do y'all live now? She asked.
Atlanta, he said. You know, out to one of them developments.
Well, I see, she said. I see.
After a second, she said it again. Finally, she asked, And who are these other boys? And smiled at them.
Garfield Smith him, and W.T. Harper him, he said, nodding his head backward first in the direction of the large boy, and then the small boy.
How do you boys do? Mrs. Cope said. This is Mrs. Pritchard. Mr. and Mrs. Pritchard work here now.
They ignored Mrs. Pritchard, who watched them with steady, beady eyes. The three seemed to hang there waiting, watching Mrs. Cope.
Well, well, she said, glancing at the suitcase. It's nice of you to stop and see me. I think that was real sweet of you.
Powell's stare seemed to pinch her like a pair of tongs.
Come back to see how you's doing, he said hoarsely. Listen here,
the smallest boy said. All the time we've been knowing him, he's been telling us about this here place. Said it was everything here. Said it was horses here. Said he had the best time of his entire life right here on this here place. Talks about it all the time.
Never shuts his trap about this place, the big boy grunted, drawing his arm across his nose as if to muffle his words.
Always talking about them horses he rid here, the small one continued. And he said he would let us ride them, too, said it was one named Gene.
Mrs. Cope was always afraid someone would get hurt on her place and sue her for everything she had.
They aren't shod, she said quickly. There was one named Gene, but he's dead now, but I'm afraid you boys can't ride the horses because you might get hurt. They're dangerous, she said, speaking very fast.
The large boy sat down on the ground with a noise of disgust and began to finger rocks out of his tennis shoe. The small one darted looks here and there, and Powell fixed her with his stare and didn't say anything. After a minute, the little boy said,
"Say, lady, you know what he said one time? He said when he died he wanted to come here."
For a second, Mrs. Cope looked blank, then she blushed. Then a peculiar look of pain came over her face, as she realized that these children were hungry. They were staring because they were hungry. She almost gasped in their faces, and then she asked them quickly if they would have something to eat. They said they would, but their expressions, composed and unsatisfied, didn't lighten any. They looked as if they were used to being hungry, and it was no business of hers. The child upstairs had grown red in the face with excitement. She was kneeling down by the window so that only her eyes and forehead showed over the sill. Mrs. Cope told the boys to come around on the other side of the house where the lawn chairs were, and she led the way, and Mrs. Pritchard followed. The child moved from the right bedroom across the hall and over into the left bedroom and looked down on the other side of the house, where there were three white lawn chairs and a red hammock strung between two hazelnut trees. She was a pale, fat girl of 12 with a frowning squint and a large mouth full of silver bands. She knelt down at the window. The three boys came around the corner of the house, and the large one threw himself into the hammock and lit a stub of cigarette. The small boy tumbled down on the grass next to the black suitcase and rested his head on it. And Powell sat down on the edge of one of the chairs and looked as if he were trying to enclose the whole place in one encircling stare. The child heard her mother and Mrs. Pritchard in a muted conference in the kitchen. She got up and went out into the hall and leaned over the banisters. Mrs. Cope's and Mrs. Pritchard's legs were facing each other in the back hall.
"Those poor children are hungry," Mrs. Cope said in a dead voice.
"You seen that suitcase?" Mrs. Pritchard asked. "What if they intend to spend the night with you?"
Mrs. Cope gave a slight shriek.
"I can't have three boys in here with only me and Sally Virginia," she said. "I'm sure they'll go when I feed them."
"I only know they got a suitcase," Mrs. Pritchard said.
The child hurried back to the window. The large boy was stretched out in the hammock with his wrists crossed under his head, and a cigarette stub in the center of his mouth. He spit it out in an arc just as Mrs. Cope came around the corner of the house with a plate of crackers. She stopped instantly as if a snake had been slung in her path.
"Ashfield," she said, "please pick that up. I'm afraid of fires."
"Garfield,"
the little boy shouted indignantly.
"Garfield."
The large boy raised himself without a word and lumbered for the butt. He picked it up and put it in his pocket and stood with his back to her, examining a tattooed heart on his forearm. Mrs. Pritchard came up holding three Coca-Colas by the necks in one hand and gave one to each of them.
"I remember everything about this place," Powell said, looking down the opening of his bottle.
"Where did you all go when you left here?"
Mrs. Cope asked, and put the plate of crackers on the arm of his chair. He looked at it, but didn't take one. He said,
"I remember it was one named Gene, and it was one named George. We gone to Florida, and my daddy, he, you know, died. And then we gone to my sister's, and then my mother, she, you know, mad. And we been there ever since."
There are some crackers, Mrs. Cope said, and sat down in the chair across from him.
He don't like Atlanta, the little boy said, sitting up and reaching indifferently for a cracker. He ain't never satisfied with where he's at except this place here. Let me tell you what he'll do, lady. We'll be playing ball, see, on this here place in this development we got to play ball on, see? And he'll quit playing and say, God damn, it was a horse down there named Gene, and if I had him here, I'd bust this concrete to hell riding him.
I'm sure Powell doesn't use words like that, do you, Powell? Mrs. Cope said.
No, ma'am, Powell said.
His head was turned completely to the side as if he were listening for the horses in the field.
I don't like them kind of crackers, the little boy said, and returned his to the plate and got up.
Mrs. Cope shifted in her chair.
So you boys live in one of those nice new developments, she said.
The only way you can tell your own is by smell,
the small boy volunteered. They're 4 stories high and there's 10 of them, one behind the other.
Let's go see them horses, he said.
Powell turned his pinching look on Mrs. Cope.
We thought we would just spend the night in your barn, he said. My uncle brought us this far on his pickup truck, and he's going to stop for us again in the morning.
There was a moment in which she didn't say a thing, and the child in the window thought, she's going to fly out of that chair and hit the tree.
Well, I'm afraid you can't do that, she said, getting up suddenly. The barn's full of hay, and I'm afraid of fire from your cigarettes.
We won't smoke, he said.
I'm afraid you can't spend the night in there just the same, she repeated, as if she were talking politely to a gangster.
Well, we can camp out in the woods then, the little boy said. We brought our own blankets anyways. That's what we got in that there suitcase. Come on.
In the woods, she said. Oh, no, the woods are very dry now. I can't have people smoking in my woods. You'll have to camp out in the field, in this field here next to the house where there aren't any trees.
Where she can keep her eye on you, the child said under her breath.
Her woods, the large boy muttered, and got out of the hammock. We'll sleep in the field, Powell said, but not particularly as if he were talking to her. This afternoon I'm going to show them about this place.
The other two were already walking away, and he got up and bounded after them, and the two women sat with the black suitcase between them.
Not no thank you, not no nothing, Mrs. Pritchard remarked.
They only played with what we gave them to eat, Mrs. Cope said in a hurt voice.
Mrs. Pritchard suggested that they might not like soft drinks.
They certainly looked hungry, Mrs. Cope said.
About sunset, they appeared out of the woods, dirty and sweating, and came to the back porch and asked for water. They did not ask for food, but Mrs. Cope could tell they wanted it.
All I have is some cold guinea, she said. Would you boys like some guinea and some sandwiches?
I wouldn't eat nothing bald-headed like a guinea, the little boy said. I would eat a chicken or a turkey, but not no guinea.
Dog wouldn't eat one of them, the large boy said.
He had taken off his shirt and stuck it in the back of his trousers like a tail. Mrs. Cope carefully avoided looking at him. The little boy had a cut on his arm.
You boys haven't been riding the horses when I asked you not to, have you?
She asked suspiciously, and they all said, No, ma'am. At once, in loud, enthusiastic voices like the amens that are said in country churches. She went into the house and made them sandwiches, and while she did it, she held a conversation with them from inside the kitchen, asking what their fathers did and how many brothers and sisters they had and where they went to school. They answered in short, explosive sentences, pushing each other's shoulders and doubling up with laughter as if the questions had meanings she didn't know about.
And do you have men teachers or lady teachers at your school? She asked.
Some of both and some you can't tell which,
the big boy hooted.
And does your mother work, Powell?
She asked quickly.
She asked you, does your mother work?
The little boy yelled.
His mind's affected by them horses he only looked at. He said,
His mother, she works at a factory and leaves him to mind the rest of them, only he don't mind them much. Let me tell you, lady, one time he locked his little brother in a box and set it on fire.
I'm sure Powell wouldn't do a thing like that, she said, coming out with the plate of sandwiches and setting it down on the step. They emptied the plate at once, and she picked it up and stood holding it, looking at the sun which was going down in front of them, almost on top of the tree line. It was swollen and flame-colored and hung in a net of ragged cloud, as if it might burn through any second and fall into the woods. From the upstairs window, the child saw her shiver and catch both arms to her sides.
"We have so much to be thankful for," she said suddenly in a mournful, marveling tone. "Do you boys thank God every night for all he's done for you? Do you thank him for everything?"
This put an instant hush over them. They bit into the sandwiches as if they had lost all taste for food.
"Do you?" she persisted.
They were as silent as thieves hiding. They chewed it without a sound.
"Well, I know I do," she said at length,
and turned and went back to the house, and the child watched their shoulders drop. The large one stretched his legs out as if he were releasing himself from a trap. The sun burned so fast that it seemed to be trying to set everything in sight on fire. The whitewater tower was glazed pink, and the grass was an unnatural green, as if it were turning to glass. The child suddenly stuck her head far out the window and said, "Rrrr!" in a loud voice, crossing her eyes and hanging her tongue out as far as possible, as if she were going to vomit. The large boy looked up and stared at her.
"Jesus," he growled, "another woman."
She dropped back from the window and stood with her back against the wall, squinting fiercely as if she had been slapped in the face and couldn't see who had done it. As soon as they left the steps, she came down into the kitchen where Mrs. Cope was washing the dishes.
"If I had that big boy down, I'd beat the daylight out of him," she said.
"You keep away from those boys," Mrs. Cope said, turning sharply. "Ladies don't beat the daylight out of people. You keep out of their way. They'll be gone in the morning." But in the morning, they were not gone. When she went out on the porch after breakfast, they were standing around the back door, kicking the steps. They were smelling the bacon she had had for breakfast.
"Why, boys," she said, "I thought you were going to meet your uncle."
They had the same look of hardened hunger that had pained her yesterday, but today she felt faintly provoked. The big boy turned his back at once, and the small one squatted down and began to scratch in the sand.
"We ain't, though," Powell said.
The big boy turned his head just enough to take in a small section of her and said,
"We ain't bothering nothing yours."
He couldn't see the way her eyes enlarged, but he could take note of the significant silence. After a minute, she said in an almost altered voice,
"Would you boys care for some breakfast?"
"We got plenty of our own food," the big boy said. "We don't want nothing of yours."
She kept her eyes on Powell. His thin white face seemed to confront, but not actually to see her.
"You boys know that I'm glad to have you," she said. "But I expect you to behave. I expect you to act like gentlemen."
They stood there, each looking in a different direction, as if they were waiting for her to leave.
"After all," she said in a suddenly high voice, "this is my place."
The big boy made some ambiguous noise, and they turned and walked off toward the barn, leaving her there with a shocked look as if she had had a searchlight thrown on her in the middle of the night. In a little while, Mrs. Pritchard came over and stood in the kitchen door with her cheek against the edge of it.
"I reckon you know they rode them horses all yesterday afternoon," she said. "Stole a bridle out of the saddle room, rode bareback because Hollis seen them. He run them out of the barn at 9 o'clock last night, and then he run them out of the milk room this morning, and there was milk all over their mouths like they'd been drinking out of the cans."
"I cannot have this," Mrs. Cope said, and stood at the sink with both fists knotted at her sides. "I cannot have this." And her expression was the same as when she tore at the nut grass.
"There ain't a thing you can do about it," Mrs. Pritchard said. What I expect is you'll have them for a week or so until school begins. They just figure it to have themselves a vacation in the country, and there ain't nothing you can do but fold your hands.
I do not fold my hands, Mrs. Cope said. Tell Mr. Pritchard to put the horses up in the stalls.
He's already did that. You take a boy 13-year-old as equal in meanness to a man twice his age. It's no telling what he'll think up to do. You'll never know where he'll strike next. This morning Hollis seen them behind the bullpen, and that big one asked if it wasn't some place they could wash at, and Hollis said no it wasn't, and that you didn't want no boys dropping cigarette butts in your woods, and he said she don't own them woods, and Hollis said she does too, and that there little one, he said, man, God owns them woods and her too. And then that there one with the glasses said, I reckon she owns the sky over this place too. And that there little one said, owns the sky and can't no airplane go over here without she says so. And then the big one says, I never seen a place with so many damn women on it. How do you stand it here? And Hollis said he had done had enough of their big talk by then, and he turned and walked off without giving no reply one way or the other.
I'm going out there and tell those boys they can get a ride away from here on the milk truck, Mrs. Cope said. And she went out the back door, leaving Mrs. Pritchard and the child together in the kitchen.
Listen, the child said. I could handle them quicker than that.
Yeah, Mrs. Pritchard murmured, giving her a long, leering look. How'd you handle them?
The child gripped both hands together and made a contorted face as if she were strangling someone.
They'd handle you, Mrs. Pritchard said with satisfaction.
The child retired to the upstairs window to get out of her way and look down where her mother was walking off from the three boys who were squatting under the water tower, eating something out of a cracker box. She heard her come in the kitchen door and say, they say they'll go on the milk truck, and no wonder they aren't hungry. They have that suitcase half full of food.
Likely stole every bit of it, too, Mrs. Pritchard said.
When the milk truck came, the three boys were nowhere in sight. But as soon as it left without them, their three faces appeared, looking out of the opening in the top of the calf barn.
Can you beat this? Mrs. Cope said, standing at one of the upstairs windows with her hands at her hips. It's not that I wouldn't be glad to have them. It's their attitude.
You never liked nobody's attitude, the child said. I'll go tell them they got 5 minutes to leave here in.
Fast. I'm going out there and give them a piece of my mind, Mrs. Cope said. The child took over the position in the window, and in a few minutes she saw the stiff green hat catching the glint of the sun as her mother crossed the road toward the calf barn. The three faces immediately disappeared from the opening, and in a second, the large boy dashed across the lot, followed an instant later by the other two. Mrs. Pritchard came out, and the two women started for the grove of trees the boys had vanished into. Presently, the two sun hats disappeared in the woods, and the three boys came out at the left side of it, and ambled across the field and into another patch of woods. By the time Mrs. Cope and Mrs. Pritchard reached the field, it was empty, and there was nothing for them to do but come home again. Mrs. Cope had not been inside long before Mrs. Pritchard came running toward the house, shouting something.
"They've let out the bull!" she hollered. "Let out the bull!"
And in a second she was followed by the bull himself, ambling, black and leisurely, with four geese hissing at his heels. He was not mean until hurried,
and it took Mr. Pritchard and the two Negroes a half hour to ease him back to his pen.
While the men were engaged in this, the boys let the oil out of the three tractors and then disappeared again into the woods. Two blue veins had come out on either side of Mrs. Cope's forehead, and Mrs. Pritchard observed them with satisfaction.
Like I told you, she said, there ain't a thing you can do about it.
Mrs. Cope ate her dinner hastily, not conscious that she had her sun hat on. Every time she heard a noise, she jumped up. Mrs. Pritchard came over immediately after dinner and said, well, you want to know where they are now? And smiled in an omniscient, rewarded way.
I want to know at once, Mrs. Cope said, coming to an almost military attention.
Down to the road, throwing rocks at your mailbox, Mrs. Pritchard said, leaning comfortably in the door. Dunn already about knocked it off its stand. "Get in the car," Mrs. Cope said. The child got in, too, and the three of them drove down the road to the gate. The boys were sitting on the embankment on the other side of the highway, aiming rocks across the road at the mailbox. Mrs. Cope stopped the car almost directly beneath them and looked up out of her window. The three of them stared at her as if they had never seen her before. The large boy with a sullen glare, the small one glint-eyed and unsmiling, and Powell with his two-sided glassed gaze hanging vacantly over the crippled destroyer on his shirt. "Powell," she said, "I'm sure your mother would be ashamed of you." And she stopped and waited for this to make its effect. His face seemed to twist slightly, but he continued to look through her at nothing in particular. "Now, I've put up with this as long as I can," she said. "I've tried to be nice to you boys. Haven't I been nice to you boys?" They might have been three statues, except that the big one, barely opening his mouth, said, "We're not even on your side of the road, lady." "There ain't a thing you can do about it," Mrs. Pritchard hissed loudly. The child was sitting on the back seat close to the side. She had a furious, outraged look on her face, but she kept her head drawn back from the window so that they couldn't see her. Mrs. Cope spoke slowly, emphasizing every word. "I think I have been very nice to you boys. I've fed you twice. Now, I'm going into town, and if you're still here when I come back, I'll call the sheriff." And with this, she drove off. The child, turning quickly so that she could see out the back window, observed that they had not moved. They had not even turned their heads. "You done angered them now," Mrs. Pritchard said, "and it ain't any telling what they'll do." "They'll be gone when we get back," Mrs. Cope said. Mrs. Pritchard could not stand an anticlimax. She required the taste of blood from time to time to keep her equilibrium. "I known a man once that his wife was poisoned by a child she had adopted out of pure kindness," she said. When they returned from town, the boys were not on the embankment, and she said, "I would rather to see them than not to see them. When you see them, you know what they're doing." "Ridiculous," Mrs. Cope muttered. "I've scared them, and they've gone, and now we can forget them." "I ain't forgetting them," Mrs. Pritchard said. "I wouldn't be none surprised if they didn't have a gun in that there suitcase." Mrs. Cope prided herself on the way she handled the type of mind that Mrs. Pritchard had. When Mrs. Pritchard saw signs and omens, she exposed them calmly for the figments of imagination that they were. But this afternoon her nerves were taut, and she said, "Now I've had about enough of this. Those boys are gone, and that's that." "Well, we'll wait and see," Mrs. Pritchard said. Everything was quiet for the rest of the afternoon, but at supper time, Mrs. Pritchard came over to say that she had heard a high, vicious laugh pierce out of the bushes near the hog pen. It was an evil laugh, full of calculated meanness, and she had heard it come three times, herself, distinctly. "I haven't heard a thing," Mrs. Cope said. "I look for them to strike just after dark," Mrs. Pritchard said. That night Mrs. Cope and the child sat on the porch until nearly 10 o'clock, and nothing happened. The only sounds came from tree frogs and one whippoorwill who called faster and faster from the same spot of darkness. "They've gone," Mrs. Cope said. "Poor things." And she began to tell the child how much they had to be thankful for. For she said they might have had to live in a development themselves, or they might have been Negroes, or they might have been in iron lungs, or they might have been Europeans, ridden in boxcars like cattle. And she began a litany of her blessings in a stricken voice that the child, straining her attention for a sudden shriek in the dark, didn't listen to. There was no sign of them the next morning either. The fortress line of trees was a hard granite blue. The wind had risen overnight, and the sun had come up a pale gold. The season was changing. Even a small change in the weather made Mrs. Cope thankful. But when the seasons changed, she seemed almost frightened at her good fortune, in escaping whatever it was that pursued her. As she sometimes did when one thing was finished and another about to begin, She turned her attention to the child, who had put on a pair of overalls over her dress, and had pulled a man's old felt hat down as far as it would go on her head, and was arming herself with two pistols in a decorated holster that she had fastened around her waist. The hat was very tight and seemed to be squeezing the redness into her face. It came down almost to the tops of her glasses. Mrs. Cope watched her with a tragic look. "Why do you have to look like an idiot?" she asked. "Suppose company were to come. When are you going to grow up? What's to become of you? I look at you and I want to cry. Sometimes you look like you might belong to Mrs. Pritchard." "Leave me be," the child said in a high, irritated voice. "Leave me be. Just leave me be. I ain't you." And she went off to the woods as if she were stalking out an enemy, her head thrust forward and each hand gripped on a gun. Mrs. Pritchard came over, sour-humored, because she didn't have anything calamitous to report. "I've got misery in my face today," she said, holding on to what she could salvage. "These here teeth, they each one feel like an individual boil." The child crashed through the woods, making the fallen leaves sound ominous under her feet. The sun had risen a little and was only a white hole like an opening for the wind to escape through in a sky a little darker than itself, and the tops of the trees were black against the glare. "I'm going to get you," she said. "I'm going to get you one by one and beat you black and blue. Line up, line up," she said, and waved one of the pistols at a cluster of long, bare-trunked pines, four times her height, as she passed them. She kept moving, muttering, and growling to herself, and occasionally hitting out with one of the guns at a branch that got in her way. From time to time, she stopped to remove the thorn vine that caught in her shirt, and she would say, "Leave me be, I told you. Leave me be," and give it a crack with the pistol and then stalk on. Presently, she sat down on a stump to cool off, but she planted both feet carefully and firmly on the ground. She lifted them and put them down several times, grinding them fiercely into the dirt as if she were crushing something under her heels. Suddenly, she heard a laugh. She sat up, prickle-skinned. It came again. She heard the sound of splashing, and she stood up, uncertain which way to run. She was not far from where this patch of woods ended and the back pasture began. She eased toward the pasture, careful not to make a sound, and coming suddenly to the edge of it, she saw the three boys, not 20 feet away, washing in the cow trough. Their clothes were piled against the black valise out of reach of the water that flowed over the side of the tank. The large boy was standing up, and the small one was trying to climb onto his shoulders. Powell was sitting down looking straight ahead through glasses that were splashed with water. He was not paying any attention to the other two. The trees must have looked like green waterfalls through his wet glasses. The child stood partly hidden behind a pine trunk, the side of her face pressed into the bark. "I wish I lived here," the little boy shouted, balancing with his knees clutched around the big one's head. "I'm goddamn glad I don't," the big boy panted, and jumped up to dislodge him. Powell sat without moving, without seeming to know that the other two were behind him, and looked straight ahead, like a ghost sprung upright in his coffin.
"If this place was not here anymore," he said, "you'd never have to think of it again." "Listen," the big boy said, sitting down quietly in the water with the little one still moored to his shoulders. "It don't belong to nobody."
"It's ours," the little boy said.
The child behind the tree did not move. Powell jumped out of the trough and began to run. He ran all the way around the field as if something were after him, and as he passed the tank again, the other two jumped out and raced with him, the sun glinting on their long, wet bodies. The big one ran the fastest and was the leader. They dashed around the field twice and finally dropped down by their clothes and lay there with their ribs moving up and down. After a while, the big one said hoarsely,
"Do you know what I'd do with this place if I had a chance?"
"No, what?"
the little boy said, and sat up to give him his full attention.
"I'd build a big parking lot on it or something," he muttered.
They began to dress. The sun made two white spots on Powell's glasses and blotted out his eyes.
I know what let's do, he said.
He took something small from his pocket and showed it to them. For almost a minute, they sat looking at what he had in his hand. Then, without any more discussion, Powell picked up the suitcase and they got up and moved past the child and entered the woods not 10 feet from where she was standing. Slightly away from the tree now, with the imprint of the bark embossed red and white on the side of her face. She watched with a dazed stare as they stopped and collected all the matches they had between them and began to set the brush on fire. They began to whoop and holler and beat their hands over their mouths, and in a few seconds, there was a narrow line of fire widening between her and them. While she watched, it reached up from the brush, snatching and biting at the lowest branches of the trees. The wind carried rags of it higher, and the boys disappeared, shrieking behind it. She turned and tried to run across the field, but her legs were too heavy, and she stood there, weighted down with some new unplaced misery that she had never felt before. But finally, she began to run. Mrs. Cope and Mrs. Pritchard were in the field behind the barn when Mrs. Cope saw smoke rising from the woods across the pasture. She shrieked, and Mrs. Pritchard pointed up the road to where the child came loping heavily, screaming, "Mama! Mama! They're going to build a parking lot here!" Mrs. Cope began to scream for the Negroes, while Mrs. Pritchard, charged now, ran down the road shouting. Mr. Pritchard came out of the open end of the barn, and the two Negroes stopped filling the manure spreader in the lot and started toward Mrs. Cope with their shovels.
"Hurry! Hurry!" she shouted. "Start throwing dirt on it!"
They passed her almost without looking at her and headed off slowly across the field toward the smoke. She ran after them a little way, shrilling,
"Hurry! Hurry! Don't you see it? Don't you see it?"
"It'll be there when we get there," Culver said,
and they thrust their shoulders forward a little and went on at the same pace. The child came to a stop beside her mother and stared up at her face as if she had never seen it before. It was the face of the new misery she felt, but on her mother it looked old, and it looked as if it might have belonged to anybody, a Negro or a European or to Powell himself. The child turned her head quickly, and past the Negro's ambling figures she could see the column of smoke rising and widening unchecked inside the granite line of trees. She stood taut, listening, and could just catch in the distance a few wild, high shrieks of joy, as if the prophets were dancing in the fiery furnace, in the circle the angel had cleared for them. A Late Encounter with the Enemy. General Sash was 104 years old. He lived with his granddaughter, Sally Poker Sash, who was 62 years old, and who prayed every night on her knees that he would live until her graduation from college. The general didn't give two slaps for her graduation, but he never doubted he would live for it. Living had got to be such a habit with him that he couldn't conceive of any other condition. A graduation exercise was not exactly his idea of a good time, even if, as she said, he would be expected to sit on the stage in his uniform. She said there would be a long procession of teachers and students in their robes, but there wouldn't be anything to equal him in his uniform. He knew this well enough without her telling him, and as for the damn procession, it could march to hell and back and not cause him a quiver. He liked parades with floats full of Miss Americas and Miss Daytona Beaches and Miss Queen Cotton products. He didn't have any use for processions, and a procession full of school teachers was about as deadly as the River Styx, to his way of thinking. However, he was willing to sit on the stage in his uniform so that they could see him. Sally Poker was not as sure as he was that he would live until her graduation. There had not been any perceptible change in him for the last 5 years, but she had the sense that she might be cheated out of her triumph, because she so often was. She had been going to summer school every year for the past 20 because when she started teaching, there were no such things as degrees. In those times, she said, everything was normal, but nothing had been normal since she was 16.
and for the past 20 summers, when she should have been resting, she had had to take a trunk in the burning heat to the state teacher's college, and though when she returned in the fall, she always taught in the exact way she had been taught not to teach. This was a mild revenge that didn't satisfy her sense of justice. She wanted the general at her graduation because she wanted to show what she stood for, or, as she said, what all was behind her. And was not behind them. This them was not anybody in particular. It was just all the upstarts who had turned the world on its head and unsettled the ways of decent living. She meant to stand on that platform in August with the general sitting in his wheelchair on the stage behind her. And she meant to hold her head very high as if she were saying, "See him? See him? My kin, all you upstarts! Glorious, upright old man standing for the old traditions, dignity, honor, courage. See him." One night in her sleep she screamed, "See him! See him!" and turned her head and found him sitting in his wheelchair, behind her with a terrible expression on his face, and with all his clothes off except the general's hat. And she had waked up and had not dared go back to sleep again that night. For his part, the general would not have consented even to attend her graduation if she had not promised to see to it that he sit on the stage. He liked to sit on any stage. He considered that he was still a very handsome man. When he had been able to stand up, he had measured 5 feet 4 inches of pure gamecock. He had white hair that reached to his shoulders behind, and he would not wear teeth because he thought his profile was more striking without them. When he put on his full-dress general's uniform, he knew well enough that there was nothing to match him anywhere. This was not the same uniform he had worn in the war between the states. He had not actually been a general in that war. He had probably been a foot soldier. He didn't remember what he had been. In fact, he didn't remember that war at all. It was like his feet, which hung down now shriveled at the very end of him without feeling, covered with a blue-gray afghan that Sally Poker had crocheted when she was a little girl. He didn't remember the Spanish-American War in which he had lost a son. He didn't even remember the son. He didn't have any use for history, because he never expected to meet it again. To his mind, history was connected with processions, and life with parades, and he liked parades. People were always asking him if he remembered this or that, a dreary black procession of questions about the past. There was only one event in the past that had any significance for him, and that he cared to talk about. That was 12 years ago when he had received the general's uniform and had been in the premiere. "I was in that premiere they had in Atlanta," he would tell visitors sitting on his front porch, "surrounded by beautiful girls. It wasn't a thing local about it. It was nothing local about it. Listen here. It was a national event, and they had me in it up onto the stage. There's no bobtails at it. Every person at it had paid $10 to get in and had to wear his tuxedo. I was in this uniform. A beautiful girl presented me with it that afternoon in a hotel room. It was in a suite in the hotel, and I was in it too, Papa," Sally Poker would say, winking at the visitors. "You weren't alone with any young lady in a hotel room. Was I to known what to do?" the old general would say with a sharp look, and the visitors would scream with laughter. "This is a Hollywood, California girl," he'd continue. "She was from Hollywood, California, and didn't have any part in the picture. Out there they have so many beautiful girls that they don't need, that they call them a extra, and they don't use them for nothing but presenting people with things and having their pictures taken. They took my picture with her. No, it was two of them, one on either side of me in the middle with my arms around each of them's waist, and their waist ain't any bigger than $0.50. Sally Poker would interrupt again. "It was Mr. Govisky that gave you the uniform, Papa, and he gave me the most exquisite corsage. Really, I wish you could have seen it."
It was made with gladiola petals taken off and painted gold and put back together to look like a rose. It was exquisite. I wish you could have seen it.
It was as big as her head, the general would snarl. I was telling it. They give me this uniform and they give me this sword, and they say, now, general, we don't want you to start a war on us. All we want you to do is march right up on that stage when you're introduced tonight and answer a few questions. Think you can do that? Think I can do it? I say, listen here. I was doing things before you were born. And they hollered.
He was the hit of the show, Sally Poker would say, but she didn't much like to remember the premiere on account of what had happened to her feet at it. She had bought a new dress for the occasion, a long black crepe dinner dress with a rhinestone buckle and a bolero, and a pair of silver slippers to wear with it, because she was supposed to go up on the stage with him to keep him from falling. Everything was arranged for them. A real limousine came at 8:10 and took them to the theater. It drew up under the marquee at exactly the right time, after the big stars and the director and the author and the governor and the mayor and some less important stars. The police kept traffic from jamming, and there were ropes to keep the people off who couldn't go. All the people who couldn't go watched them step out of the limousine into the lights. Then they walked down the red and gold foyer, and an usherette in a Confederate cap and a little short skirt conducted them to their special seats. The audience was already there, and a group of UDC members began to clap when they saw the general in his uniform, and that started everybody to clap. A few more celebrities came after them, and then the doors closed and the lights went down. A young man with blonde, wavy hair who said he represented the motion picture industry came out and began to introduce everybody, and each one who was introduced walked up on the stage and said how really happy he was to be here for this great event. The general and his granddaughter were introduced 16th on the program. He was introduced as General Tennessee Flint Rock Sash of the Confederacy. Though Sally Poker had told Mr. Govisky that his name was George Poker Sash and that he had only been a major. She helped him up from his seat, but her heart was beating so fast she didn't know whether she'd make it herself. The old man walked up the aisle slowly, with his fierce white head high and his hat held over his heart. The orchestra began to play the Confederate battle hymn very softly, and the UDC members rose as a group and did not sit down again until the general was on the stage. When he reached the center of the stage with Sally Poker just behind him, guarding his elbow, the orchestra burst out in a loud rendition of the battle hymn, and the old man, with a real stage presence, gave a vigorous, trembling salute, and stood at attention until the last blast had died away. Two of the usherettes in Confederate caps and short skirts held a Confederate and a Union flag crossed behind them. The general stood in the exact center of the spotlight, and it caught a weird moon-shaped slice of Sally Poker. The corsage, the rhinestone buckle, and one hand clenched around a white glove and a handkerchief. The young man with the blonde, wavy hair inserted himself into the circle of light and said he was really happy to have here tonight for this great event. One, he said, who had fought and bled in the battles they would soon see daringly reacted on the screen. And, tell me, General, he asked, how old are you? 92, the general screamed. The young man looked as if this were